Welcome to VOA Asia Weekend, our weekly compilation of the top stories making news over the past week. On today's program, the U.S. president announces a new round of tariffs, these aimed at China.
It could be about $60 billion, but that's really just a fraction of what we're talking about.
Still no word this past week from North Korea on planned talks between their leader, Kim Jong-un, and President Trump. South Korea says no worry.
We believe the North Korean leader is now taking stock.
And we explore the theft of a very rare relic from what was supposed to be a secret location in Australia. All of those stories and much more over the next hour on VOA Asia Weekend. I'm Ira Melman in Washington, D.C. U.S. President Donald Trump imposed tougher economic sanctions on China Thursday, setting the stage for $60 billion in new tariffs on Chinese imports that could quickly lead to a trade war with Beijing. The U.S. leader targeted China's alleged years-long theft of U.S. intellectual property, imposing new restrictions on Chinese investment in the U.S. that mirror regulations that American companies face when they invest in China.
We have a tremendous intellectual property theft situation going on, which likewise is hundreds of billions of dollars, and that's on a yearly basis.
The president said the United States will use a so-called Section 301 trade tool against China, which gives the United States government the power to unilaterally impose sanctions against countries which it says are not trading fairly.
In particular with China, we're going to be doing a Section 301 trade action. It could be about $60 billion, but that's really just a fraction of what we're talking about. I've been speaking with the highest Chinese representatives, including the president, and I've asked them to reduce the trade deficit immediately by $100 billion.
The last time the Section 301 trade tool was wielded was two decades ago by the administration of then-President Bill Clinton against Japan to pry open that country's automotive sector. President Trump says the U.S. wants reciprocal trade and tariff deals with China and other countries.
When they charge 25% for a car to go in, and we charge 2% for their car to come into the United States, that's not good. That's how China rebuilt itself. The tremendous money that we've paid since the founding of the World Trade Organization, which has actually been a disaster for us, it's been very unfair to us.
Trump has repeatedly said China has been ripping off the United States, a point he emphasized numerous times in public remarks, during which he has harshly criticized his predecessors for not doing anything about it. The announcement comes a week after the president signed new tariffs for imported steel and aluminum. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross said Thursday that the intellectual property action and the metal tariffs are two sides of the same coin.
This action on intellectual property rights deals with the future. So we're trying to solve both today's problem and problems that otherwise will be forthcoming. That's why these actions are so important and so important in unison with each other. We will end up negotiating these things rather than fighting over them, in my view.
There is opposition to that idea. Joining us on VOA Asia is Aaron Ennis, the Senior Vice President of the U.S.-China Business Council. Aaron, what's your organization's take on these proposed tariffs?
Well, I think the first thing to keep in mind is why we're even considering actions against China. The context for this is a case that was filed last August that talked about IP protection and forced technology transfer in China. These are two really interesting and important issues for companies that do business in China, but there have been ongoing challenges for years, and companies want to see solutions to those problems. An efforts to try to get China to move on those two issues, to improve IP protection and to eliminate requirements for technology transfer. It might include tariffs. It might include investment restrictions. We've heard it might include visas. At this point, we don't know the specifics, though.
So it sounds like you're talking about a possible negotiating tactic.
Well, I guess we will know soon enough, won't we?
Yeah.
Actually, under U.S. law, that's the first thing that's supposed to happen, is the U.S. is supposed to request consultations, which is just a fancy way of saying try to negotiate a solution. Because the U.S. is viewing this under a U.S. law rather than under the WTO, China has been reluctant to talk to the U.S. in formal ways so far. But certainly, a negotiated solution would probably be the best outcome for everyone.
If there is the case that these tariffs do go through, the reports say they would be placed across a wide range of consumer goods, from apparel to electronics, also agricultural products. What effect do you think this would have on U.S. businesses and consumers?
Well, so the first question that we ask when we look at this is, how are tariffs going to try to address those two issues that I mentioned, IP enforcement and technology transfer? And right now, it's unclear. How will putting tariffs on a product get China to want to come to the table on it? So we're hoping the administration's going to spell out exactly what their plan is of how tariffs might help to achieve that goal. But in general, what we think will happen is, you know, frankly, we're going to see an increase in the cost of products that come to the U.S., and we might see some reaction from the Chinese in response as well. But, you know, those reactions are probably going to be varied, and we're not going to know a lot about it. But the bottom line is, much of what we import from China, we're importing from there because supply chains have moved to China. And if the cost of producing a product in China becomes higher because of a tariff, we should expect that there'll be some movement of production of products out of China, not necessarily back to the U.S., but probably more likely to other countries in the area, like Vietnam or Malaysia or Indonesia. And that means that we're not going to be importing as much product from China, but we are going to be importing it probably from whomever the next lowest cost producer is.
Has your council had any communication with the administration?
We're in regular communication with the administration and have encouraged them on all of these points, both to identify what exactly their strategy is on how using the various remedies they're considering are going to address the problems, encouraging both the U.S. and the Chinese governments directly that the best outcome of this is a negotiated solution, as you alluded at the beginning, because what we really want to see here is the problem solved, not just an increase in the cost of products because we have a disagreement.
Aaron Ennis is Senior Vice President of the U.S.-China Business Council. Aaron, thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
We invite you to read more on our stories by following us on Facebook at VOA Asia and the VOAnews.com website. This is VOA Asia Weekend. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Diplomatic efforts are intensifying to coordinate the logistics and agendas for expected North Korea summits with South Korea and then with the United States to work out a deal to end the North's nuclear weapons program. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un opened the door to nuclear disarmament talks by agreeing to an inter-Korean summit with South Korean leader Moon Jae-in and extending an invitation to meet with U.S. President Donald Trump. Kim agreed to discuss ending his country's threatening nuclear arms program, which in the past year has accelerated efforts to develop an intercontinental ballistic missile that could target the U.S. mainland, and to hold off on further provocative weapons testing while talks are underway. President Trump's decision to agree to denuclearization talks by the end of May caught allies and adversaries by surprise. The Trump administration, however, has said that its hardline maximum pressure campaign would remain in place until a deal is reached. Under Trump, the U.S. has led international efforts to impose increasing economic sanctions on the North and has stressed that military action is also a viable option to end the growing nuclear threat. North Korea has not yet confirmed its participation in either summit, but South Korean Foreign Minister Kang Kyung-hwa said on Sunday that the leadership in Pyongyang is still trying to formulate its response to Trump's sudden embrace of diplomacy.
I think we were all quite
surprised by the readiness of that decision. I think it was an extremely courageous decision on the part of President Trump. We believe the North Korean leader is now taking stock.
Now, the South Korean foreign minister said on the CBS program Face the Nation that she's not troubled by the fact that Kim Jong-un's commitment to engage in denuclearization talks has so far only been communicated through a high-level South Korean envoy who met with the North Korean leader.
But the significance of his word is quite weighty, in the sense that this is the first time that the words came directly from the North Korean supreme leader himself, and that has never been done before.
Another indication that a U.S.-North Korea summit is in the planning stages is that North Korean Foreign Minister Ri Yong-ho visited his Swedish counterpart Margot Wallström over the weekend for security talks. Ri's visit has generated speculation that Stockholm may host the Trump-Kim summit. Many analysts say Trump should seek a neutral summit site for both leaders to be on equal diplomatic footing and to withhold a U.S. presidential visit to Pyongyang, one that would greatly enhance the legitimacy of the Kim government until after significant denuclearization concessions are made. South Korean media also reported that there was progress made toward releasing three Americans being held in custody in North Korea during the talks in Sweden. Meanwhile, in San Francisco over the weekend, top national security advisors from the United States, South Korea, and Japan also met to discuss the complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, according to South Korea's presidential Blue House. South Koreans are increasingly optimistic about the prospects for peace following U.S. President Trump's surprising decision to meet with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un to resolve the nuclear standoff on the Korean Peninsula. VOA's Seoul correspondent Brian Patton reported on recent polls that indicate high approval ratings for the intense diplomatic efforts underway.
Overall, people on the streets of Seoul are hopeful about expected North Korean nuclear talks.
No one likes war, not North Korea here or surrounding countries as well. So I think it will go toward peace.
More than 70% of respondents to a recent South Korean public opinion poll were in favor of the expected summits between North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and South Korean President Moon Jae-in in April, and then in May between Kim and U.S. President Donald Trump. North Korea this year opened the door to nuclear disarmament talks by suspending further intercontinental ballistic missile tests to potentially target the U.S. mainland, and by participating in the Pyeongchang Olympics in the South. The North Korean leader then told a South Korean envoy that he is willing to engage in denuclearization talks. More than 60% of South Korean respondents in the poll were skeptical North Korea would abide by the terms of a denuclearization deal.
I think we cannot trust 100% of what North Koreans say on denuclearization, as they are so good at lying.
And we're prepared for anything, right?
Trump, for the first time, gained a higher favorability rating than Chinese President Xi Jinping in a South Korean survey after he agreed to meet with Kim without preconditions while emphasizing sanctions would remain in place until a nuclear deal is reached. In another poll, Moon's approval rating increased to more than 70% in response to his proactive diplomatic efforts to facilitate denuclearization talks.
I do not know what the outcome will be, but I think that the attempt itself is meaningful.
Planning for the nuclear summits are underway, even though North Korea has not yet confirmed its participation. The degree to which North Korea will actually go to dismantle its nuclear program in order to end harsh U.S.-led sanctions remains a key issue to be resolved. Brian Patton, VOA News, Seoul.
U.S. lawmakers differ widely on the wisdom of President Donald Trump meeting with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un to defuse nuclear tensions between the two countries and on the likely outcome of such an encounter. VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman has more.
A Trump-Kim meeting could be a once-in-a-generation opportunity to avert nuclear confrontation or a foolish gambit, depending on who is speaking on Capitol Hill. Some lawmakers are optimistic.
My view is go big. Let's end the Korean War. I support this engagement by the president. I think him meeting with the leader of North Korea is the last best chance to avoid a war.
Others are deeply skeptical.
Well, I'm not certain that the president ought to initially meet with Kim Jong-un. I'm not sure I want to give him the benefit of being seen with the president of the United States.
Senator Kennedy doubts Kim's willingness to denuclearize his country or that he would keep any pledge to scrap North Korea's atomic program. He also questions how denuclearization would be verified if agreed to.
I support the most drastic sanctions that can possibly be created. I want to hit him so hard with sanctions that he coughs up bones.
Many Democrats, meanwhile, question the readiness of the Trump administration for what would be the most consequential nuclear summit since former President Ronald Reagan's encounters with then-Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev in the 1980s.
And we're talking about the highest level life and death nuclear negotiation in modern times. And we don't have a Secretary of State. We don't have the leaders. We have a question about the national security advisors to the president. This administration is in disarray.
The Senate is expected to vote on Trump's pick for Secretary of State, current CIA Director Mike Pompeo, next month.
I met with Mr. Pompeo today. I think they're working on a game plan. The goal is the right goal, is to get them to abandon their nuclear program completely. South Korea doesn't have one. Japan doesn't have one.
North Korea's official media have yet to acknowledge that a Trump-Kim meeting is under discussion. If preliminary consultations involving the Trump administration and Pyongyang are taking place ahead of a nuclear summit, they are occurring far from public view. Michael Bowman, VOA News, the Capitol.
Southeast Asian leaders and Australia's prime minister last Sunday called on North Korea to end its nuclear program and urged United Nations countries to fully implement sanctions. Leaders at the first summit of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, known as ASEAN, issued a joint statement with host nation Australia.
We've affirmed our joint commitment to respond strongly and resolutely in the face of the grave concerns we share about North Korea's reckless and illegal nuclear missile programs.
Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull. The joint statement urged North Korea to immediately and fully comply with its obligations under all relevant United Nations Security Council resolutions and called on all countries to implement the sanctions. Singapore's Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong, the current chair of ASEAN, said the bloc had been encouraged by negotiations for the spring summit and had noted recent developments.
On the Korean Peninsula, we have noted reports of North Korea's commitment to denuclearization and its pledge to refrain from further nuclear and missile tests during this period. And we've also noted the recently announced plans for President Donald Trump and the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un to meet in the near future. We are cautiously encouraged by these developments. The situation on the Korean Peninsula is a complicated problem which will take time to resolve. And we hope these recent steps will contribute towards lasting peace and stability.
U.S. President Donald Trump and South Korean President Moon Jae-in, who are both planning to meet North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un this spring, last week pledged to maintain maximum pressure on his authoritarian regime and seek action on giving up his nuclear weapons. You're listening to VOA Asia Weekend. A prehistoric tooth from one of the largest sharks ever known has gone missing from a secret location in a remote World Heritage area in Western Australia. Police are investigating the theft of the rare megalodon tooth discovered in the Cape Range National Park. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The location of the rare tooth in Western Australia was thought to have been highly secret. The well-preserved fossil was stolen from the spot where it was discovered, just as wildlife rangers were looking to protect it from theft with a bulletproof glass cover or a wire cage. The disappearance of the megalodon tooth, which could be worth thousands of dollars to collectors, is now being investigated by police in Western Australia. Investigators believe the fossil could have been taken by an amateur collector or by someone who wants to sell it on the black market. It's just one of a small number of megalodon specimens in the Ningaloo Coast World Heritage Area of Western Australia. Arvid Hogstrom from Parks and Wildlife in Western Australia says the tooth's whereabouts remain a mystery.
The sharks have known to be extinct for about 1.6 million years, so it's at least sort of that old. It's been floating around on the seafloor for quite some time and been pushed up in the ranges and sitting there undisturbed for however long, and someone's come along with a bit of a chisel and taken it away. We're not sure where it's gone.
The ancient shark grew to more than 15 metres long and weighed around 20 tonnes, roughly three times as heavy as a Tyrannosaurus rex. Researchers believe this ancient beast of the sea preyed on prehistoric turtles and whales, which it would kill with jaws so strong they could crush a car. The reason for the shark's extinction is unknown, but experts have speculated that Megalodon was unable to adapt as the temperature of the Earth's oceans fell. Wildlife authorities in Western Australia have circulated a picture of the missing tooth on social media as they intensify their efforts to recover the fossil, which is a priceless link to the region's ancient past. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Chinese President Xi Jinping has issued a stern warning to Taiwan as he began his second term in office, telling the self-ruled island it would face the punishment of history if it made any attempt toward separatism. Xi's comments came Tuesday as China's largely rubber-stamped National People's Congress wrapped up an historic legislative session that voted to amend the Constitution, scrap presidential term limits, and grant Xi a mandate to rule indefinitely. How might the United States react to the Taiwan element of President Xi's speech? At least one expert thinks not. I spoke with Shelley Rigger, professor of East Asian politics at Davidson College in North Carolina.
I think this is pretty consistent with the kind of long-term position that the Chinese leadership has been taking on Taiwan. It is boilerplate in some ways. You know, at every one of these major meetings, they need to say something to kind of reaffirm that position. So I don't think it's inconsistent with the past, but it is certainly a strong statement, and so intended to be heard as such.
Last week, President Trump signed the Taiwan Travel Act. It encourages U.S. officials to travel to the island, meet with their counterparts, and vice versa. Did that lead to what Xi had said, or is it just more of that boilerplate stuff?
I think the passage of the Taiwan Travel Act certainly moves that issue up on the priority list to be mentioned and, you know, for a strong statement at the national meetings, and may also have had the effect of making the statement a little bit stronger and also a little bit more directed toward the U.S. as opposed to, you know, solely toward Taiwan itself.
Does this look like brinksmanship to you, or is it well below that?
I think it's well below brinksmanship. I mean, brinksmanship would be if Xi himself were talking about deadlines or, you know, he did mention a red line, which is moving toward for Taiwan to make a grab for actual formal independence. But he doesn't talk about, you know, it has to be done in a certain amount of time. Some of the folks who have commented on his statements, both most recently and over the whole period that he's been in office have said, you know, we think he's got this deadline or that deadline. But I think it's significant that the PRC has refrained from stating any deadline for, as they would put it, kind of solving the Taiwan issue, because what that means is he is, in fact, trying to maintain a degree of flexibility, and I think that's probably a good thing.
Does the Taiwan Travel Act change the way the United States has acted in its relationship toward Taiwan, thinking about what China would have to say or do?
In the past, previous administrations would have taken that kind of guidance and said, thank you, you know, we register your preference here, and they would have gone back to doing what they always do, which is to try to balance a good relationship, a supportive relationship with Taiwan, against the need to not activate the PRC too strongly. I would have said, you know, a couple of years ago that it probably wouldn't make much difference in U.S. policy. However, with the current administration, all bets are off, and, you know, the White House may see this as just exactly the kind of thing that they will, you know, take Congress's Taiwan Travel Act and raise them. Who knows? And I think that that is probably partially responsible for, you know, President Xi's relatively strong reaction this time, is to make sure that the Trump administration understands that this is not something that the Beijing government can just look away from.
Shelley Rigger, professor of East Asian politics at Davidson University. China's top legislative body, the National People's Congress, gathered for its annual meeting in Beijing. After it voted to remove presidential term limits the previous week, the nearly 3,000 delegates heard a set of proposals that will overhaul the structure of Chinese central government, also known as the State Council and led by the Premier. Among the biggest changes are the consolidation of national banking and insurance regulators, the establishment of an environmental super ministry, and a supervisory commission that will oversee disciplinary matters of all public sector employees. VOA Asia intern Harry Chen spoke with Dr. Ming Sha, professor of political science at the City University of New York, who has researched Chinese leadership and political development. He explained implications of the reshuffle.
First, let's talk about environment, because environment used to be an independent bureau, but because the environment issue had become a big issue, especially under Xi Jinping, this had become the source of dissent or protests. So for Xi Jinping, and his legitimacy depends on people's satisfaction with his work over the environment. And so this is how the environment has been consolidated and put into some other ministries. And in terms of banking and insurance, because Chinese government is facing a major potential financial crisis, because the Chinese Communist Party created a new committee to prevent financial crisis.
So how successful do you think this super ministry have been? And what about the chances of further consolidation of these ministries?
When we talk about super ministries, I think we have different tracks. One track, I can say it was proposed more by Li Keqiang, and from the angle of the State Council. So Li Keqiang wanted to consolidate the ministries into bigger ones. So I think that would is easier for him to supervise all the ministries and the functions to coordinate the work of the State Council. But I think there is another development that is more from Xi Jinping, because Xi Jinping has proposed a lot of super national committees, like the National Security Committee and also the National Supervision Committee. So all these committees, they are above the State Council. So I think, and we have to keep in mind, even Li Keqiang wants to consolidate the ministries within the State Council, but actually a lot of functions have been taken away by the national committees, which are above the State Council. In Xi Jinping's idea, he has created more committees. So Xi Jinping is trying to govern by committees, but with the marginalized role for Li Keqiang, no matter what Li Keqiang is trying to do, and his super ministries cannot be very powerful in comparison to the newly created super commissions under auspices of Xi Jinping.
Some people say that consolidating government agencies into super ministries can breed more abuse of power and corruption because few officials would have even more power because they were incorporating all the other ministries' responsibilities. Do you think that's true?
I think no matter you have petty bureaucrats or more powerful bureaucrats, I think their behavior is not going to be changed by merger or by centralization. Because if you don't have the accountability, so it means the government officials, if they are more responsible to the officials above them or to top leaders, but they don't have a democratic accountability or responsiveness to ordinary people. Because really ordinary people, they have no mechanisms to control the government officials or to hold them accountable. So this is why I think no matter what the Chinese government reshuffle for their ministries, I think it's not going to change the fundamental relationship between the ruled and the ruling classes.
Dr. Ming Xia, professor of political science at the City University of New York, speaking with VOA Asia intern Harry Chen. You're listening to VOA Asia Weekend. 4 years after street art arrived in India, colorful murals are transforming urban landscapes in major cities like Mumbai and New Delhi in a variety of places, from slums to rail stations. The appeal is not just visual. Anjana Pasricha told us these outdoor paintings are helping brighten the environment of rundown urban spaces and putting the common man in touch with art as it frees it from the confines of galleries.
These birds at a metro station in New Delhi symbolize freedom and hope and send a message to passersby: fly high. A nondescript residential neighborhood in the Indian capital has turned into a public art district after artists plastered its walls with larger-than-life paintings. Street art is picking up momentum, says Julia Ambroji, whose foundation is at the forefront of the movement.
So there are like many more initiatives which are like starting up in small villages, in like smaller towns. And then at the same time, like we see many artists which perhaps earlier they would have never thought about a wall as a canvas, that instead are like really interested in exploring this new medium.
Perhaps the most dramatic transformation has taken place in a Mumbai slum, where the vibrant coat of colors has prompted comparisons with Italy's picturesque Positano village. The Mumbai-based not-for-profit Chal Rangde or Let Us Color initiated the project to change the slum's drab environment. The paintings by artists and volunteers reflect the life of slum dwellers, an auto rickshaw which many men drive, a pet kitten, inspirational messages for the young. City resident Didipia Reddy, who led the project, says street art alters perspectives.
And we feel like adding a dash of color does a lot of change than you would just think that, you know, oh, it's just color. It's not. Because it gives you a sense of hope. It gives you a sense of, you know, this thing that everything's going to be all right.
Attitudes are changing. Proud residents keep the slum clean and don't let people spit or vandalize. And the neighborhood's vibe has changed, says resident Pushpa Raj Shetty.
If the place is dull, life seems dull. People don't even recognize each other. If it is colorful, people have a different smile on their face.
For those living in urban sprawls that are becoming more crowded and rundown, street art is a breath of fresh air. Like for New Delhi resident Sonia Vij, who has joined a walk to appreciate the murals.
I think it's a great way to like discover new things about your city and just kind of stay in love with Delhi, which becomes hard as time goes by.
Along with Indian artists, several international artists have been involved in projects by the START Foundation. Ambroji, who comes from Italy, says the effort is to transcend national boundaries.
Melting pots is what make our countries great. So that's what we are trying actually to open up. Like, so really mixing and blending like different influences from everywhere.
For the time being, this splash of color is giving some public spaces a makeover. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
With the rising cost of health care in the United States and the growing demand for services by those who can least afford them, two doctors in Clarkston, Georgia, made a commitment to do something about it. Founded 5 years ago, the nonprofit Clarkston Community Health Center wanted to make a difference by providing free treatments and services for lower-income residents in the city of Clarkston and its surrounding communities. Since then, the clinic has expanded its services to provide free laboratory diagnostics and prescription medications for refugees. Salah Damager from VOA's Kurdish service visited the clinic and filed this report.
At this clinic in Georgia, doctors volunteer around the clock to help patients who have no medical insurance. Pharmacist Saeed Rais, president and co-founder of the clinic, points to a tremendous need in the community.
The refugees who are coming here, they are provided refugee aid for about 8 months, and after they're on their own. A lot of them, and you can see, they can't even speak English, and then you expect them to go get a job and have health insurance through their job or be able to purchase their own, it's almost impossible. We see about 70 to 75 patients every Sunday in 4 hours.
Doctors Rais and Gulshan Harji, who have a combined total of 35 years in medicine, came up with the idea for a free clinic in 2013.
It took us almost a year to put the bylaws, to put the paperwork together, to get our 501c, to put a board together. And then it took us another almost a year to find this space that would be conducive to our work.
Many of their clients speak English poorly or not at all, so the clinic always has translators on hand.
So we have staff who speak several languages. Like, for example, Dr. Harji herself speaks 6 languages. I can handle 3 or 4. And then we have other staff, and then you saw we have some interpreters that were provided by Emory medical students who train them, the Burmese and Rohingya, and then we have Arabic interpreters. And on top of that, we have access via phone.
In addition to basic care, the clinic also provides preventive health care and low-cost prescriptions.
We offer, mammogram, we offer other, tests and immunizations, and we also provide free medications to people who have, and if we have that medication, otherwise we refer them to the pharmacy where they can go get low-cost medications.
For many patients, the clinic serves as an essential safety net.
Insurance is so high right now, and a lot of people can't afford insurance. We need more places like this.
I have children, but we are facing financial difficulties. I am sick, my husband is old, sick, not able to work, and we need to pay our apartment rent. The center helps us a lot, and doctors here are very kind and friendly.
Besides getting their most urgent medical needs addressed, patients say the clinic is also a place for moral support, a caring oasis that helps lower-income people overcome some of the daily hardships they face. Saleh Demijer, VOA, Clarkson, Georgia.
Governments need to rely more on green water management to ensure a healthy planet and meet the needs of a fast-growing global population. That is one of the messages in a new study by the UN's cultural and scientific organization, UNESCO. Launched at a World Water Conference in Brazil, the study considers the many benefits of natural water infrastructure, like wetlands, urban gardens, and sustainable farming practices.
Population growth, changing consumption patterns, and development are taking their toll on the world's water supplies. Water demand is increasing by about 1% a year, even as climate change, pollution, and erosion threaten its quality and availability. But until now, most countries have relied on traditional man-made water management systems, such as reservoirs, irrigation canals, and water treatment plants. A new UNESCO report finds that very little investment has gone into greener water management options, despite their many benefits.
Green solutions can meet several water management objectives at the same time, improving water quality, but also reducing floods or droughts, improving access to water. So there's multiple benefits outside the water sector.
Stefan Uhlenbrook is coordinator of UNESCO's World Water Assessment Program, which authored the study.
Green solutions can help to store carbon, create jobs, particularly in rural environments. They can also increase the biodiversity, which is also very essential.
The goal, UNESCO says, is not to scrap traditional water management options like dikes, but instead to strike the right balance between man-made systems and those relying more on Mother Nature. Some places are starting to do that. New York City saves hundreds of millions of dollars yearly in water treatment and maintenance by protecting vast natural watersheds. China plans to build pilot initiatives that recycle rainwater for urban consumption. Some communities are building artificial wetlands to fight flooding and pollution. Others, like the Indian state of Rajasthan, have adopted more sustainable soil and water management practices that boost harvests and fight drought, growing challenges in the future.
We have to grow some 50% more food in the next 30 to 40 years. So to do that, we have to think of how can we do that without cutting more forests, cutting more trees, and trying to develop more land, which is hardly possible in many places around the world.
Experts say greener water management can help to increase agricultural production by 20%, which may prove key in feeding a global population expected to reach nearly 10 billion by 2050. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
You're in tune with VOA Asia Weekend. Make sure you join us online as well. Space scientists say the satellites and other spacecraft orbiting the Earth, including the International Space Station, are in increasing danger of collision with pieces of junk. Engineers are working hard to solve the problem of removing the trash that threatens functioning satellites worth millions of dollars. We soar with VOA's George Pudich as he floats details to us.
The problem of space junk can be solved in two ways, says Luisa Innocenti, head of the European Space Agency's Clean Space Office.
The problem of the space debris has to be fixed in two ways. First one, we need to stop polluting. And second way, we have to remove the garbage, if you want, and the debris.
Both methods are hard to implement. There is no international treaty for minimizing space debris, although individual nations have rules for deorbiting dysfunctional equipment or removing it to the so-called graveyard orbit. In the meantime, the amount of junk keeps growing because occasional collisions create additional smaller pieces that cannot be controlled or captured. ESA scientist Jesus Gil Fernandez says the agency is experimenting with a robotic arm that could capture larger pieces and move them to safer areas.
We use the camera, which is mounted on the smaller robot arm, to mimic, to reproduce the motion of the satellite around the target satellite that we want to deorbit, to capture.
Italian scientist Michele Lavagna says old satellites could be captured with special nets.
So the concept is to, to mimic what the fishermen do on the sea, and so to have a very large net to stay away from our debris and med satellites that is stumbling and moving freely, and then from that distance to keep our net, and you just try to wrap all over your satellites.
Others, like ESA's Benoît Bonvoisin, study the possibility of building satellites that could be less hazardous and lower the pollution of both space and Earth.
Right now, we're trying to understand what happens to the materials we use, and then we'll see how we can improve them, how we can work on the design and conception of the satellite, how the different parts of the satellite break up in relation to each other, in order to have a satellite which is safer at the end of its life and creates the smallest amount of debris on Earth.
But for now, there are no dates set for the first real-life space junk pickup. George Pudich, VOA News.
Much of Asia is prone to earthquakes. Recovering from a major tremor is often a long, painful, and difficult process. Researchers have found that a data-driven approach to disaster preparedness can help cities at risk bounce back after earthquakes. VOA's Faith Lapidus has an explanation.
Like most tall buildings in downtown Los Angeles, this 33-story high-rise is wired up with earthquake monitoring sensors.
In Los Angeles, it's mandated that quote-unquote tall buildings be instrumented.
Those instruments are often tucked away where you wouldn't even think to look for them.
Well, the big one we all know is going to come. And in Southern California, there's an expectation that it's overdue.
With support from the National Science Foundation, UCLA structural engineers John Wallace and Henry Burton are exploring new ways to build resilience into urban clusters, dense cityscapes packed with tall buildings vulnerable to earthquakes, like downtown Los Angeles.
What I consider the 21st century challenge is being able to engineer earthquake-resilient communities. And by resilient, what we mean is in the event of a major earthquake, we're able to minimize the initial impact, adapt to any major changes that happen as a result of the earthquake, and recover in a timely manner.
Key to that is data. This is an accelerometer, the workhorse of the LA Earthquake Monitoring Network. It measures how much a building sways during seismic events. Thousands of them in tall buildings all over the city record data around the clock. But after an earthquake, analyzing that data is not high on the city's agenda. It's done in some buildings, but Wallace and Burton want to see a citywide rapid assessment process. They're using the data to verify and refine models that predict how tall buildings will respond to earthquakes. They say data from shake table tests like these can only get you so far. Their new models incorporate performance data from actual buildings.
After an earthquake, you have to have engineers go to buildings individually and inspect those buildings and make a decision on whether or not the building is safe to occupy. Part of what models and systems we will be developing will be able to do is to serve to help guide these engineers in terms of looking for the hotspots.
Burton says the challenge to building more resilient urban centers is for engineers to think beyond the structural integrity of any single tall building to non-structural components like water and power and how those can be protected from damage. They say their new methods could save lives and money beyond Los Angeles in other cities rocked by significant earthquakes. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
One of Australia's most successful Aboriginal mentoring projects is bringing its methods to South Africa and Uganda. From Sydney, Phil Mercer had the story.
When the Australian Indigenous Mentoring Experience, or AIM, began in 2005, it served just 25 Aboriginal children in Sydney. Since then, the program has grown rapidly, providing opportunities to 15,000 Indigenous high school students by pairing them with thousands of university undergraduates who provide free tutoring. At the heart of AIM's work is time. University students give their time for free to teach and guide Indigenous high school pupils between the ages of 12 and 18. These youngsters in turn are given time to visit university campuses, to attend workshops, and they can stay in the system for their entire high school careers. The scheme has helped some of Australia's most disadvantaged youngsters finish high school, go to university, and find a job. The mentoring program will be exported later this year to Uganda and South Africa. The founder of AIM, Jack Manning Bancroft, has recently returned to Sydney from a trip to Africa, where he explained his vision to students at the University of Pretoria.
You know, I said to them, I don't pretend to know anything about South Africa. You know, I've read Nelson's story, he's been a hero of mine, but I don't pretend to know your country. What I do know is that this model can mobilise volunteers, it can move between two incredibly important infrastructures, and we can move quickly, and we can build a global movement around this, which can have an energy and a force. And we're very good at mentoring, we're good at leading people, we're good at guiding people on principles. And they were really excited because it's not someone coming in saying, I have the solution for you. It's I have a template of which you can build it yourselves. I see our model being like IKEA for furniture. We just give the tools and let people put it together themselves, and that's why it works.
Indigenous groups say that education is the greatest single weapon to overcome disadvantage. But despite the concerted efforts of state and federal authorities, charities and other welfare groups, educational inequality persists. Disadvantage is entrenched, and while improvements in educational achievements are being made, many Indigenous students do poorly at school. About 60% of Aboriginal children are already well behind their non-Indigenous counterparts when they start school at the age of five. Australia's original inhabitants make up about 3% of the national population, but suffer disproportionately high rates of poverty, unemployment, and imprisonment. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Last week, there was a big boost for the world's largest bike-sharing service. But as VOA Asia's Jim Stevenson says, there is competition.
China-based Ofo, the world's first and largest station-free bike-sharing company, has raised more than $860 million from e-commerce giant Alibaba and other investors to expand its overseas operations. Founded in 2014, Ofo boasts 200 million users in 250 cities in more than 20 countries, using its signature yellow bikes as a way to improve urban transportation by reducing traffic congestion, offer inexpensive travel, and save energy. But Ofo has seen growing competition in China, with the rise of Mobike backed by Chinese internet giant Tencent and other thrift-based services, such as U.S.-based lodging giant Airbnb and ride-hailing phenom Uber. Taylor Bennett, a Virginia-based Ofo spokesman, explains to VOA the bike sharing's convenience and value.
We have a smart lock technology on the back of a bike, and the bike's kind of, if you think about ride sharing, it's a similar concept. It's bike sharing where you can open your app and find a bike around you. You ride that bike for $1 an hour with Ofo and then park it where you need to be, and you just lock it up with a smart lock. So there's no docking stations involved, no walking to find an open rack or a place to park. You park it wherever you can legally leave that bike and then walk away, and it'll be locked behind you with the smart lock. The concept was born in China, where our co-founder is actually volunteer teaching and kind of came up with this concept of, you know, what if everyone had access to a bike anytime, anywhere, because he used to commute long distances to school, as did a lot of the teachers and students. And so thought, why not make this easier for everyone and increase mobility and access? And the idea was born from there.
Bennett offers his take on the head of Ofo operations in France, who says the popular bike share company in China tackles the first and last mile, connecting people at home and the closest transport station.
There's a lot of benefits that come with dockless bike sharing, and that being one of them. You know, here in the U.S. and across the globe, we see, you know, it's really a transportation solution for that first mile, last mile, as you mentioned. And it's people who are, a distance from a metro stop or a bus stop, or don't have a car, and, you know, there may not be other forms of transportation. Dockless bike sharing coming into cities has really given people greater mobility, more access to transportation options. It's very convenient because of the dockless model, but it's also really affordable in that it's $1 an hour. So when you compare that to, you know, whether it's public transportation or Uber or Lyft, it's really a very affordable way to get around town.
Not everyone is happy with the dockless bike service, which allows bikes to be left anywhere, as careless users sometimes park them on footpaths and even on roads.
It's a new model, and the dockless system is one that just was not around, especially here in the U.S., even 8 months ago. And so there's a lot of education that goes into it. And, you know, when we enter new communities, we really focus on teaching people how the model works, how properly to use the system, but also how properly to park, best practices for leading bikes, and where not to. And so, you know, along with that education about dockless and how it works and who Ofo is, there's a lot of education that goes into it in terms of just being a proper and effective and efficient user of the system. And that's something that we really take very seriously and work with our local communities and advocates to help us do. But also, a big reason we have local operations teams is to really help manage those bikes. And so if they're left in places that are, either blocking a right-of-way or, you know, on private property, we can respond in real time, get those bikes rebalanced to proper locations. And so, you know, local teams are really important, as is the education component.
Taylor Bennett said the concept of bike sharing is not new, but the dockless model, with its value and convenience, has been widely accepted by local officials and customers, and new users are usually brought in by word of mouth, not marketing outreach. The bright yellow bikes can be seen right here in downtown Washington.
As we continue, tourist numbers in Indonesia swelled last year on the back of overseas advertising and infrastructure development. President Joko Widodo has said he wants to create 10 tourist destinations like the island of Bali. But the pleasing economic numbers also come with a social and environmental cost as rampant development threatens ecosystems and traditional livelihoods. Jack Houston has more.
There's no denying it. Indonesia is a beautiful country, and its government wants to spread the word. Its Wonderful Indonesia advertising campaign has helped to boost tourist numbers to 14 million visitors last year, up 22%. But the growth may come at a cost, with critics saying there is a risk of overdevelopment. Here at Benoa Bay in Bali, fishermen are fighting against a land reclamation to build a luxury resort, including a theme park, casino, and even a Formula One track.
Secara pribadi, saya sangat tidak senang.
Personally, I am very unhappy about the reclamation of Benoa Bay. Our community of fishermen that live on the bay will be most affected by the impact of the reclamation. It will be difficult for them to start a new job with a new skill because they have been fishermen from generation to generation.
In addition to destroying mangroves and fishing grounds, the local activists say the development will block access to religious sites and cause tidal flooding. Here at a demonstration outside the Bali governor's office, the Reject the Reclamation movement has become a touchstone for those who feel overdevelopment is damaging to Bali's culture and environment.
Actually, for us, tourism development in Bali is a failed tourism development because it tends to be mass tourism. So far in this practice, mass tourism has only brought benefits to a limited few people, but brings losses to the community as its resources are eroded.
Even without the reclamation, many fear Bali will be unable to deal with the water and waste management issues that have resulted from mass tourism. The Ministry of Tourism plans to develop 10 more destinations across the archipelago into Bali-style resorts. But critics fear that developmental excesses could be repeated. The government hopes to boost visitor numbers to 17 million this year, and according to the Ministry of Tourism, the vast majority of those visitors will come for cultural and nature tourism. But despite this, a ministry spokesman declined to oppose such a man-made destination as the Benoa Bay development.
Our position, we're still waiting for the process to develop this bay. And if local people agree to develop, we will develop. If not yet agree about this, we should consider meeting again and discuss again.
According to Dadang, an integrated management plan will serve to avoid repeating some of the overdevelopment that's been seen in Bali. Indonesia's striking vistas and warm people means it remains an enticing travel destination, but locals and those who have visited this archipelago are likely to hope development plans don't sully its immense natural beauty. Jack Hewson for VOA News, Bali.
Fingerprints can unlock doors, phones and more, but are consumers ready to pay with them? Visa thinks so. More companies are exploring biometrics, the analysis of unique biological traits to verify identity. But how secure is the technology? VOA's Tina Trin had the story from New York.
Fingerprints. They're used for everything from unlocking phones to gaining entry into a new country. Now, Visa is letting consumers pay with them.
Our biometric cards can allow for you to replace pen and signature by using biometric credentials.
The company is testing new cards that have built-in fingerprint readers. A user's fingerprint is compared against a previously registered pattern and used in tandem with the card's chip or contactless functionality to process transactions.
The card is trained to use your biometric thumbprint, and since your thumbprint is unique, it can only be activated by the individual that's trained the card. And it falls back to pen and signature if you're, for instance, sharing your card.
Visa is not the first to explore biometrics. Last year, MasterCard began testing a fingerprint-enabled card at Pick and Pay stores in South Africa. Not having to provide a signature or PIN number is convenient, but is it secure? Anil Jain conducts extensive research in biometrics, creating fake or spoof fingerprints.
We have shown that we can do a fairly good job in detecting spoofs versus real fingerprints. And I think in most of the cases, it's the issue of how to raise the bar for the hacker so that it is becoming more and more difficult for the hacker to attack the system. No security system is foolproof. The idea is to make it as difficult for an imposter to use it.
Jane says additional biometrics can be implemented for major purchases.
If you buy a $100,000 purchase at Tiffany's, maybe they'll ask not only your fingerprint, but your face matching and some other things. But if you're buying a $2 hamburger, you know, who cares?
According to Jane, biometrics are here to stay, especially as hardware and software costs decline and consumer adoption increases.
I mean, we post our photos on all the social media sites, right? Don't post your fingerprints also.
A bit of common sense for technology that's becoming more and more common. Tina Trin, VOA News, New York.
Thanks for being with us on VOA Asia Weekend. I'm Ira Melvin in Washington. Make sure you join us next weekend and hear and see even more on our Facebook page at VOA Asia and on our website at voanews.com. Have a great week.